The only way to remove something from that system, to take out the radioactive garbage, was to put it out New Caird's airlock. There were some distant thuds. Dinah floated forward and opened the hatch to be greeted by a garbage bag filled to the dimensions of a beach ball and all wrapped up in duct tape. Propelled by a shove from Jiro, this entered New Caird. Dinah pushed it up to Marcus, who intercepted it and tapped it sideways into the airlock. Vyacheslav slammed the hatch behind it. Then they heard a hiss, indicating that the lock had cycled. The bundle was now adrift in space. Jiro's head, then the rest of him, came through the port. He had stripped off the bunny suit and the respirator and presumably stuffed them into the garbage bag. He was sweaty and exhausted.
"Just like old times, my friend," Marcus said,
referring to Jiro's earlier career running cleanup at Fukushima.
"I don't miss it," Jiro said.
It was warm in the command module now, so they didn't need the parkas. But they all used bunny suits when they went into Ymir and stripped them off before going back into New Caird. Contamination was sneaky, as Jiro put it. The beta, emitted by a microscopic speck of fallout, could be hidden from the inspector's view by just about any random obstacle. And the command module was cluttered with those. So Jiro's initial sweep was no guarantee that tiny, beta-emitting particles weren't still hidden in there. If such particles found their way into a lung or the digestive tract, fatal radiation damage was likely to result. He had, though, identified a spacesuit glove on the lower level as being heavily contaminated, and found lower levels of contamination on some other odds and ends that had gone into that garbage bag and out the airlock. With luck, all serious sources of contamination had now been removed.
Before it had time to thaw, Vyacheslav took Sean's body down from the ceiling. Slava wasn't a life scientist, but he was a jack-of-all-trades. Bundled up in parka and moon suit, he cut the sleep sack open as Jiro stood over him with the inspector. He performed a cursory exam, then wrapped the body back into the sleep sack. He maneuvered it to the lower level, threaded it through the manhole in the middle of the floor, and then pushed it down the tunnel to the end, where Lars and the other crew member had been buried. There he stashed Sean's body against the ice wall. Somewhat ruining their appetite, he reported on the findings of this impromptu autopsy as they got ready to eat a meal in the common room.
"Sean bled to death out of his asshole," he reported. "He had an internal rupture of the bowel."
"I picked up some beta through his belly," Jiro added. "He was very emaciated at the end."
"Meaning?"
Marcus asked. "He swallowed a particle of fuel, probably a fuel flea that got loose and somehow was tracked in here." "Fuel flea?"
Jiro had used the term before. No one else knew what it meant. It had gone in one ear and out the other. Just another bit of the tech jargon that was so ubiquitous on Izzy. Now that fuel fleas were killing people, it was time to learn about them.
"A tiny piece of uranium or plutonium that has gotten loose from a ruptured rod. As it throws off alpha particles, it zigs and zags around the room. Conservation of momentum. So it hops around like a flea. The point is, it is small and it makes a lot of alpha. It lodged in a dive reticulum in his bowel. It burned through his bowel wall and started a bleed that could not stop." Everyone pushed back their food.
"Okay," Marcus said. "We eat in New Caird."
Once they had finished their meal, Marcus told everyone that they needed to sleep, since they had a busy few days ahead of them. Jiro volunteered to take the first watch, and so the rest of them slept while Jiro stayed up going through logs and notebooks, assembling a picture of all that had happened on Ymir's journey. Suddenly, they had a lot of space to spread out in. Dinah was tempted to retreat to the far end of the New Caird and get some privacy, but Marcus insisted that everyone sleep down in the command module. New Caird might be free of radioactive contamination, but it was exposed to the direct hazards of space. A bolide strike would kill anyone in it. Whereas A beta-emitting particle, inhaled into the lung, would take days or weeks to incapacitate the victim, time during which they could do useful work. So Vyacheslav ended up sleeping in one of the berths on Ymir's crew accommodation level, while Dinah and Marcus shared another. Somewhat to her surprise, they actually managed to have sex, a thing that had occurred only once since the White Sky. It was a sly surprise, not the athletic banging around that they had enjoyed the first few times they had done it, back in the good old days when the hard rain had seemed far in the future and the Cloud Ark had still felt like an isolated research colony. Ymir, now separated from the rest of the human race by millions of kilometers distance and several thousand meters per second of Delta V, now had some of that old feel to it. And despite the ghoulish scene that had greeted them on arrival, Dinah liked it here. It was the space equivalent of one of Rufus's old mining camps, and didn't really want to go back. But they were supposed to be saving the human race, not enjoying an exotic holiday, so she tried to get some sleep. When Marcus's alarm went off 5 hours later, she peeled out of the bag they'd been sleeping in and did her best to clean up and get into some fresh clothes. Ymir had long ago turned into a smelly bachelor pad, short on toiletries, and, as they discovered while rooting around in the common area, on food. Sean had definitely been killed by the fuel flea in his gut, but he had likely been weakened before then by malnutrition, and even by lack of oxygen. For the systems that the crew had been using to replenish Ymir's air supply were not in the best condition. The new arrivals were awakened twice during their sleep cycle by alarms from the life support system, which Jiro silenced and dealt with. When they were all awake, they ate food from the stores they had brought with them and listened to a briefing from Jiro. "Let me tell you what happened to this expedition," he said. And then he told them the story as he had pieced it together from the logs left behind by the dead. The failure of the radio, shortly after the beginning of the mission, had been caused by a defective part for which there was no replacement. A simple, stupid oversight. The longest leg of the trip, the year and a half spent coasting from the L1 gate to Grig Skellerup, had consisted of lengthy stretches of boredom, interrupted by occasional panics, most of which had to do with the life support system. This was based on using sunlight to grow algae, a process that worked well in the lab, but had turned out to be difficult to sustain on Ymir. The newest arclets in the Cloud Ark had benefited, in this respect, from lessons learned operating such systems in the time since Zero. But Ymir had been built and launched very early, using systems that now seemed painfully out of date. Once they had reached Greg's skeleton, and thereby gotten access to vast amounts of water, they'd been able to make oxygen by splitting H2O and life had improved. Until then, however, they'd been oxygen-hungry and tense, trying to keep their consumption of air and food to a minimum by floating listlessly in their sacks, watching the same DVDs over and over again. Health and mental status had suffered. They broke the shard from Grig Skellerup using small mining charges planted by hand, or by robots programmed by Lars. Into its nose, they embedded the command module, making themselves comparatively safe from cosmic radiation and bolides for the first time since the beginning of the mission. Life began to improve. They started excavating the access tunnel into the core. Into the aft end of the shard, they inserted the reactor system, letting it melt its way into the ice. Around it, in the heart of the shard, they began to excavate a cavity and sculpt out hoppers, containers designed to hold broken-up ice produced by the mining robots. 12 augers, long spiraling ice movers, like the ones used to transport grain into elevators, were set up to convey that loose ice from the hoppers into the space surrounding the warm reactor vessel, where it would melt and be pumped into the core itself. Meanwhile, a separate core of robots worked on the outside of the shard, melting the ice a little bit at a time, mixing it with the fibrous material they'd brought with them, and letting it refreeze into the much tougher material known as pycrete. The steampunk propulsion system had basically worked as planned, though not without a lot of tinkering and head-scratching. On the first burn, that had put it on the course back to L1. There had, however, been some problems with the augers that were used to feed ice into the reactor chamber. The augers received their inputs of ice from hoppers that had to be filled up by mining solid ice from the inside of the shard, a process for which robots were well-suited, and so nothing worked at all without the assistance of a small army of robots conveying flakes of ice from the minehead to hopper like ants dismantling a loaf of sugar. This part of it had actually worked. But some of the pieces of ice being mined by the robots had little rocks in them. These jammed the augers. Jams could often be repaired by operating the auger in reverse for a short time, but sometimes a robot, or even a person in a spacesuit, had to be sent to pry a rock out of the mechanism. An auger accident had led to the death of one member of the crew. During the months between that first burn and their arrival at L1, Lars did some programming work on the robots, trying to teach them not to collect rocky ice. They conducted a number of system tests intended to make sure that the problems they'd experienced the first time around wouldn't be repeated during the critical second burn. These ranged from small-scale tests on individual robots all the way up to full dress rehearsals where the entire system would be energized and the reactor turned on to generate thrust for a few minutes. It had been during the first of those dress rehearsals when something had gone wrong in the core, resulting in damage to the jacket of a fuel rod. Jiro had an idea as to what had gone wrong. Ymir's reactor used water, the melted ice of the comet core, as its moderator. In nuclear engineering, that meant a medium that slowed down the neutrons hurled out by fission reactors, making them more likely to stick around long enough to trigger more such reactions. In the absence of an effective moderator, the neutrons would mostly escape from the system without doing anything useful. Between being as dead as a doornail and running out of control was a narrow band of normal and healthy power output in which basically all commercial reactor operations happened. The essential problem with Ymir's reactor was that its moderator, being a naturally occurring substance, was impure and unpredictable. The water that had flooded into the chamber for the first dress rehearsal had been melted from ice a few months earlier, around the time of the initial burn, and been sitting in the plumbing system ever since then. There it had been in contact with rocks and grit that had made it through the augers. It had leached various minerals out of that rock and become something other than pure water. When the reactor was started and the pumps turned on, that impure water was drawn through screens and filters intended to exclude all the debris. But it was nonetheless impure water, and when introduced to the core, it failed to perform its function as a moderator. The reactor was sluggish to get going. With the advantage of hindsight, it could be seen that its neutron economy was suppressed, poisoned by the impurities in the water. Overreacting to the slow start, the operators had pulled the control blades out farther than they would have otherwise. But once the first rush of impure water had been flushed through the system and blown out the nozzle, it had been replaced by relatively pure water, only just now melted from the ice. The reactor's power had surged, producing a sudden buildup of fission products inside the fuel rods. Some of those would have been gases such as krypton and argon. The gases would have created pressure. Fuel rods were engineered to withstand it, but one of them had failed and ruptured. Possibly it had left the factory in excellent condition, but been damaged en route by a nanometeoroid that had left a microscopic flaw. In any case, for whatever reason, the rod burst open and began to spill out the highly radioactive daughters of nuclear fission, which had become mixed with the steam being blasted out the rocket's nozzle. Most of the fallout had, therefore, dissipated into space. But the whole point of a rocket nozzle was to convert the thermal energy in the gas, its heat, into velocity. The faster the steam went, the colder it got, until the steam near the nozzle exit was so cold that it actually began to condense into snow. Tiny particles of fallout made excellent nuclei around which a snowflake might begin to form. Some of that snow had stuck to the ice walls of the nozzle bell. The most likely explanation for what had happened next was that one of the robots crawling around in that area, maintaining the shape of the nozzle, had become contaminated with a mixture of alpha-emitting fuel fleas and beta-emitting daughters, and tracked the material to a location where it had been transferred to the glove of a spacesuit, possibly by a mechanism as simple as a spacewalker reaching down to brush some ice from the claw of a grab, or planting a foot in a location where a contaminated grab had stepped. The contamination had then been brought into the command module when the spacewalker came indoors. They might not even have known about the burst fuel rod, so they might not have been checking for contamination. Or, as suggested by Sean's note, their Geiger counters might have broken down, one by one, rendering them blind to the presence of radioactivity in their environment. In any case, the particles had spread around the command module. Some men had inhaled them, some had swallowed them. They hadn't been healthy to begin with. In any case, the good news, if it could be so called, was that the reactor and the engine basically worked. The improvements Lars had made to the robot's mining programs had led to fewer rocks in the hoppers and fewer jammed augers during the L1 burn. Since then, gnats had been crawling around in the hoppers, identifying rocks that had sneaked in anyway and pushing them away from the augers. The damage to the fuel rod would have been a major catastrophe by old Earth standards, had it happened on an Earthbound reactor. Here it was messy, and had already been fatal to a few, but everything still worked. Yes, the new CARED expedition would be bringing a radioactive disaster right into the middle of the cloud arc, but once they drew close enough, they would jettison the reactor and let it fall into the atmosphere. 48 hours, give or take a few minutes, now remained before Earth would loom huge below them, and the nadir surface of the shard would sweat and steam as the radiant heat shining up from the incandescent air softened, melted, and vaporized the ice. It was then that they would have to pull out the control blades and execute Ymir's next big burn. First, they would have to spin the whole ship around so that she was flying backward, her nozzle bell pointed in the direction of movement. For the delta V they needed was a negative one, a braking as opposed to accelerating burn. For spin moves, all spaceships were equipped with thrusters, not powerful enough to impart big delta Vs, but capable of rotating the ship as a whole into the desired attitude so that the main engine was pointing in the right direction. As a rule, the thrusters were more effective when they were situated out toward the corners of the vehicle, where they could exert more leverage and crowbar the thing around with minimal thrust. Not knowing what they were going to find at Grigg Skellerup, the mission planners for Ymir had packed aboard a collection of modular thruster assemblies that basically consisted of little rocket engines, propellant tanks, wireless control links, and hardware for anchoring them into ice. A cursory survey of Ymir and a look at the dead crew's records made it clear that Sean and his crew had embedded those packages into the ice at suitable locations. One complex up at the nose with nozzles aiming in four perpendicular directions, and four more spaced around the fattest part of the shard. Now that New Caird was docked, her engine could also be put to use in getting Ymir spun around. But this one maneuver, a 180-degree flip, which would have seemed comparatively simple in a small craft such as an arclet, was fraught with difficulties and complications in something as huge and asymmetrical as Ymir. Anticipating a need to use the thrusters, Dinah sent robots out to inspect them during that first morning, and Vyacheslav suited up and went out to do a bit of troubleshooting on a propellant line that had somehow become kinked. But so ponderous were the shard's movements that the actual rotation, end over end, consumed 8 hours, and tweaking it into precisely the right orientation then took another 6. Whereupon Marcus announced that all their assumptions were probably wrong anyway.
"The atmosphere is too big," he said.
He had been staring pensively for a long time at a string of emails from Izzy. Dinah felt a spear go through her heart. After all that had happened in the last couple of years, It was remarkable that she still had it in her to react in that way to bad news. It seemed to be some kind of built-in psychological program, triggered by phrases like, "Your mother has cancer," "There's been an explosion in the mine," or what Marcus had just said. They had known, from very early in the planning of the Cloud Ark, that the hard rain would heat up the air, all of the air, all over the world. When air got hotter, it expanded. The atmosphere had only one direction in which it could expand, out into space. So whatever drag Izzy felt from the traces of air at its accustomed altitude of some 400 kilometers was bound to get worse as the atmosphere reached upward. How hot the air would get, how much it would expand, and how heavy the drag would get were questions of colossal import that, however, simply could not be answered until the hard rain actually started. As Doob always put it, the experiment of blowing up the moon had never been attempted before. The most they could do was wait and perform observations, which was exactly what they had been doing ever since the hard rain had begun. But Marcus had been distracted for most of that time and was only now absorbing the latest results. For the Cloud Ark, of course, there were plans to cover various contingencies. In the easy case where the atmosphere didn't expand that much and the drag wasn't too bad, they didn't have to do much. In the more difficult case, which was apparently the way the experiment was now shaping up, they had no choice other than to raise the orbit of every vessel they had, Izzy herself and each arclet. The Delta Vs involved were not that large. 300 meters per second sufficed to nearly double the orbital altitude and get them well clear of the danger zone. Each arclet had its own engine and enough of a propellant supply to accomplish that. For Izzy, matters were a little more complicated. If they were willing to ditch Amalthea, they could get 300 meters per second pretty easily. Bringing Amalthea along for the ride, however, increased the propellant requirements enormously, all of which had long ago been anticipated by mission planners. This was how the dump-and-run strategy had been dreamed up in the first place. So it would be easy for the arclets to get clear of the thickening atmosphere by abandoning Izzy, at least for the time being, and jumping to higher orbit. Their drag problems would be solved. But in doing so, they would lose the ability to shelter behind Amalthea and begin to take damage from bolides. Exactly how much damage depended on how thick and fast the rocks were coming in and what the distribution of sizes was. Another one of those questions of colossal import that couldn't be answered until the hard rain had actually started and data had been gathered. And so far, the data were too thin to make any real determination. With a few spectacular exceptions, bolide impacts and casualties had been light. But this didn't mean it would remain thus. The white sky was an ever-changing phenomenon. The explosive uptick in the bolide fragmentation rate that had signaled its onset was still ongoing. The distribution of rock sizes and orbital parameters would continue changing for thousands of years. Trends could be observed and predictions could be made, but beyond a certain point, it was guesswork. At any rate, Marcus had rolled the dice on the gambit that they were now executing. If it worked, and they could slow Ymir down enough to mate her with Izzy, then the big ride strategy became possible, and the arclets could climb to higher and safer altitudes behind the shelter of Amalthea's metal and Ymir's ice. The one part of that plan that Marcus apparently had not considered until now was that the atmosphere was too big. In truth, it wouldn't have made a difference if he had considered it. The crucial decision had been made and executed weeks ago by Sean Probst, when he had laid in a course at L1 and executed the burn that had placed Ymir on its current trajectory. This was an ellipse with a very low perigee. This was a sound idea from an orbital mechanics point of view in that the steam engine would have maximum leverage at that point. It was the natural place to make a burn and effect a transition to a low circular orbit matching Izzy's. But Sick and exhausted from his 2-year odyssey, isolated from the latest scientific discourse by radio failure, Sean might have overlooked the expansion of the atmosphere when making his calculations.
Are we going in?
Vyacheslav asked. This being a polite euphemism for the scenario where Ymir got so deep and slowed down so much that it burned up and became just another streak of blue light against the lambent background of the pyrosphere.
We are more likely to skip, I think,
Marcus said, meaning that Ymir might bounce off the atmosphere like a flat rock skimming across a pond.
With unpredictable results, but I cannot be sure. All I am saying is that this is not going to be the mission plan that Sean had in his mind. It is going to be something else. Something maybe a little more exciting.
Anticipating that Camilla might be on her toes, she had already survived one attempt. The gunman had crouched behind the rear of her school bus, sawed-off shotgun at the ready, and waited for her to emerge.
A narrow stretch of pavement separated the vehicle's side door from the entrance of her school, so he didn't have much margin for error.
He jumped the gun, as it were, springing out into the open while Camilla was still negotiating the descent to the street.
The long hem of her burqa was apt to get caught on her foot as it probed for the running board, so she had to take it slowly. The delay saved her life. Alerted by a schoolteacher standing in the building's doorway, Camilla turned back into the bus. Rather than hitting her full in the face, the shotgun blast raked the left side of her jaw, removing 11 teeth, tearing away much of her cheek, and causing massive structural damage to her jaw. Surgeons in Karachi, and later London, had saved most of the functions of her tongue, rebuilt her mandible from pieces of bone carved from her pelvis, and fitted her with a set of artificial teeth. After a world tour raising money for girls' education in Afghanistan and the tribal regions of Pakistan, Camilla had been granted permanent asylum in Holland. Dutch plastic surgeons, funded by charitable donations from all over the world, had gotten to work repairing the cosmetic damage.
This was a long-term project that had been interrupted by Camilla's selection as one of the Dutch candidates for the Cloud Arc.
No one believed that this was a random outcome of the casting of lots. Clearly, the Dutch authorities had placed their thumb on the scale and seen to it that she was chosen, as a rebuke to some conservative Muslim countries who had refused to nominate female arkers unless given assurance that arrangements would be made for them to live in orbital purdah.
Camilla was well suited to serve that symbolic purpose, since she had not adopted Western ways.
She dressed conservatively and wore the headscarf and the face veil. She was coy, however, as to whether the purpose of the face veil was submission to the demands of religion or to hide her disfigurement. She had pulled it down several times to display the scars to television cameras, and when she had dined at the White House, she had gone uncovered in the dining room by prearrangement with her hostess, the President of the United States. Julia's startling arrival in the Cloud Arc had therefore led to a reunion between the 44-year-old ex-president and the 18-year-old refugee. To call it joyous or even happy would have been wrong given the circumstances. It was a fact of human nature, though, that some people just got on well with each other.
This had clearly been the case during that dinner at the White House, and was no less true in Camilla's abode, Arklet 174,
which was where Julia ended up lodging after she had recovered from her eventful flight up and gone through a bit of basic training in how to live in space. Arklet 174 belonged to a heptad, or a cluster of 7 arklets all connected to a hexagonal frame. It and 5 other arklets surrounded a 7th, which was positioned in the middle of the hexagon, where it served as a 24-hour-a-day common room and working area for the people who lived in the others. 4 to 5 people were assigned to each of those, and 2 more had been shoehorned into small private cabins at the boiler room end of the central arklet. So the total population of the heptad, including Julia, was 29. This increased to 30 when Spencer Grindstaff,
managed to hitch a ride on a flivver that was bringing a spare part and a technician from Izzy to fix a problem in one of the Arklet's thrusters. The technician returned to Izzy when he was finished, but Spencer stayed and talked his way into a berth on Arklet 215. There was a tendency for Arklets within a group to become segregated by sex over time as the population sorted themselves out. 215, which was predominantly male, ran on the same shift as 174, which was all female. They both ran on second shift, which, for reasons that were now purely historical, tended to be culturally American. They slept from dot 8 to dot 16. First shift was Asian, and third shift was European. The cultural shadings were perpetuated by food, the warm odors that greeted one's nostrils upon entering the common space first thing in the morning, the tastes one could expect to savor in the evening. Since space food was lacking in variety, this was largely a matter of spices. The second shifters had their little bottles of Tabasco, the first shifters had plastic packets of curry powder, and so on. Ganging was the term used by the architects to denote this clustering of Arklets into formations of three or seven, triads and heptads. It helped simplify perambulators' job by reducing the total number of separate objects that needed to be tracked. It gave Arkies more living space to roam around in, and provided some redundancy in the case of a bolide strike. They didn't like to form anything larger than a heptad, though.
"Spencer, I am fully aware that I am out of my depth here," Julia said. "But I don't understand the upper limit of seven. I was assured, during my early briefings, that any number of Arklets could, in principle, be ganged. Limiting it to seven seems arbitrary, which suggests that some deeper agenda might be behind it."
"One moment, please, Madam President,"
Spencer said. He was doing rather a lot of typing.
"You really shouldn't call me that," Julia returned, though her tone of voice was indulgent.
Spencer smacked his laptop's enter key, then leaned back slightly and adjusted his glasses. His eyes jumped around to various parts of the screen. Then he looked up, and in a clearer tone of voice announced,
"It's all shut down."
"The surveillance, you mean?"
"Situational Awareness Network,"
he corrected her and winked.
"Surveillance to you and me.
It's like living in the Nixon White House. Old reference, you wouldn't understand. Now, where was I?"
Kamala knew. She hadn't taken her eyes off Julia the whole time. She was on top of it.
"The agenda behind the seven Arklet limit?"
"Yes, thank you, Kamala. I don't buy their arguments. To me, it feels rather like a way of atomizing the population, keeping the Arkies from cohering into their own polity, a polity that might serve as a wholesome and desirable counterweight to the central dominance of the power structure on Izzy. Speaking of which, Spencer, I want to say how much I appreciate the work you have done in managing things on the IT front, as just now, giving us the freedom to talk among ourselves without the SAN recording our every word and gesture."
Spencer nodded as if to say, "All in a day's work." It was dot 18, the beginning of the workday for second shifters. They were in Arklet 215, home to Spencer, three other men, and a woman. The others had gone to breakfast in the common area, to exercise or to work. Spencer, Julia, and Kamala had been joined by a guest, Zeke Peterson, who had arrived by spacesuit and was still clad in his thermal coverall. He looked mildly agog. Sensing this, Julia turned toward him with a smile.
"Major Peterson," she said, "it is so good you were able to join us. Though I am new to space, I have some understanding of how difficult it is to simply drop by and say hello, as it were."
"Well, technically I am no longer a major, since that would imply the existence of a military,"
Zeke said.
"But if we are going to use extinct titles as a courtesy, then I'll just thank you for your hospitality, Madam President."
Madam President was a little while parsing that and wasn't sure if she liked it. Nervous at the silence, Zeke went on.
"I'll apologize in advance that I can't stay for very long. I'm here with a specific job to do, and once it's done, I need to move on.
Inspecting Arklet 174 for possible damage from a microbolide strike, Julia said.
Yes, ma'am.
I called it in yesterday. I could have sworn I heard a loud banging noise. It scared me to death. But there doesn't seem to be any damage. And the more time goes by, the more I wonder if I just imagined it. Space is a noisy environment. I hadn't expected that. The thrusters are so loud when they come on. Maybe it was nothing more than that. I would feel so embarrassed if I summoned you all the way out here to no purpose.
Summoned me?
Zeke asked, a little bewildered.
The incident report system is an automatic cue. The assignments are handed out at random.
Julia exchanged a mischievous look with Spencer.
You and Spencer have been together on Izzy for more than 2 years, she said. I'm sure you've come to appreciate his skills, as have I.
Zeke looked just a bit queasy.
So you got in and manipulated the cue?
Old habits die hard, Julia said. I'm accustomed to working with people I know and trust. If an inspection of my arklet is required and someone has to do it, then why not have that someone be a person I've met before? Since the assignments are handed out at random, as you say, it might as well be you.
Well, Zeke said, since you put it that way, I'm glad to be able to catch up with you for a few minutes, Madam President. Just saying that I'll have to complete the full inspection anyway, so we can close the loop on your report.
Of course, and I'll bet it will go quickly, Julia answered with a wink. Zeke, you are a member of the general population, are you not?
Of course, Zeke said. As an original member of the ISS crew, that's naturally...
But then his eyes strayed toward Spencer and his voice trailed off. Julia smiled. An awkward topic has come up, and it's best to face it with absolute transparency. Despite being a longtime trusted member of the ISS crew, Spencer here has been removed from the general population and demoted to the status of an Arky.
I wouldn't look at it as a demotion, Zeke began.
Julia silenced him with a dismissive fluttering of the fingers. These were still manicured. Camilla had been doing her nails for her. We all know it was a demotion. Marcus sprang it on Spencer when he got news of the eight ball and saw what was coming. Oh, yes. I've been filled in on all of the carefully laid plans that Marcus set into motion when his sweetheart so conveniently gave him the news. Had word of it reached us at the White House, I don't know how I would have reacted, but we were busy protecting Guru and supporting Marcus as best we knew how. Spencer here, after all those years of patient service, was replaced by that hacker boy.
Steve Lake?
Zeke asked.
Julia's eyes darted to Camilla, who nodded.
Yes, Julia said. Steve Lake. I guess he's quite clever, but obviously no competition for Spencer.
Are they in competition? Zeke asked.
In a sense, yes. When we Arkies are exposed to the all-seeing eye of San, and the G-Pop is permitted to have some semblance of privacy...
It depends on where you are in the space station.
Zeke began, but then trailed off. I wouldn't know, since I've been permitted to spend very little time there. Oh, I know the official justification. I'm not qualified to be a member of the G-Pop. By process of elimination, that makes me an Arky. Fine. But that doesn't mean I can't maintain a degree of social connection with old friends who are so privileged. Julia reached out and clasped Zeke's hand briefly.
To be sure, Zeke said. And I think that as time goes on, those two populations will cease to be thought of as separate groups.
I know that is the official dogma, Julia said, amused.
But most of that social interaction is not going to be through face-to-face visits.
So I'm told... Hard to envision how the populations will merge as long as that is the case.
Most of it is going to be happening through Spacebook and Skype and whatnot.
Zeke went on, referring to the CloudArc versions of popular internet communication apps.
At least until...
Until we all ascend into heaven and live happily ever after as one big friendly Ark, Julia said. Zeke, you know space operations better than anyone. What is your opinion of the strategy that Marcus has been foisting on us? The big ride. Even the name seems a bit suggestive, doesn't it, of, I don't know what.
She exchanged a look with Camilla, who giggled at the witticism.
Zeke looked around. You don't need to worry about that, Julia reassured him.
About what?
Marcus's surveillance network.
San, I wasn't worried about it,
Zeke protested.
Just thinking.
About what, pray tell?
Major Peterson, all kidding aside, I really am quite keen to hear your opinions as an expert. To tell you the truth, I'm thinking about how thin the walls of this pressure hull are,
Zeke said.
When you called in that bolide strike yesterday, you sounded pretty alarmed. I heard the message. Well, you had every reason to be alarmed. I do this for a living now. I go out and inspect these craters, big and small, that are piling up on our equipment. I patch holes, repair stuff that's broken, and twice now I've had to handle fatalities. It's no joke. If Marcus sees an opportunity for us to ascend into heaven, as you put it, behind the shelter of Amalthea, well, I think it's worth a try.
Is Amalthea going to shelter us from the thickening atmosphere? Camilla here has been reading the technical reports for me, which Spencer has been so good as to download from the server. She tells me it's quite serious.
The expansion of the atmosphere? It's damn serious,
Zeke said.
But Izzy's ballistic coefficient, with Amalthea attached, is huge. She can plow through some pretty thick air, and the rock will absorb all the heat. And Arklets can ride along in her wake, like bicyclists drafting behind a truck.
All of the Arklets? Zeke swallowed.
No. She doesn't make a big enough bow wave to shield all of the Arklets, unless they fly so close together that perambulator goes nuts.
This is the part of Marcus's plan that I can't understand, Julia said. What is to happen to all of the Arklets that are not afforded the privilege of nestling into Amalthea's wake?
I don't know all the details of the plan,
Zeke said.
It is fluid.
Meaning, it's not really a plan, Julia said.
It depends on when Ymir gets back, what kind of condition she's in, how much ice she has. Then we'll make a plan.
And is that to be a dictatorial process, under the, whatever it's called, the martial law thing?
Peace apps, Camilla said.
Zeke shrugged.
I don't think Marcus is going to put it up for a vote. He'll get together with his brain trust and they'll decide.
Why bother consulting the brain trust? Julia asked, as if the idea were a fascinating novelty.
To bring in different perspectives? Make sure they're not missing anything?
Are there any Arkies in this brain trust? Or are we expected to meekly accept its verdict?
Zeke was flummoxed. Had he been given the ability to rewind and replay the conversation, he would see that he'd been outmaneuvered. Lacking that perspective, he was tongue-tied for now. Julia wasn't.
I ask only because I've been getting to know a lot of Arkies. I have nothing else to do. No duties, no applicable skills. I find that many of them crave a bit of society. It's a natural human need, just as much as sleep and exercise. So I talk to them, in person here on our little heptad, or through the channels you mentioned, the Spacebook and the Scape. These young people find it at least a novelty to have a conversation with a lonely and bored ex-president. My point being, Major Peterson, that our system worked. The casting of lots and the training camps produced the brightest collection of young talent it has ever been my privilege to encounter. They are brimming over with energy and ideas. These are the scarcest resources in our universe right now.
Scarcer than water, scarcer than living space.
And as such, I'd consider it a shame if their energy was wasted, and their ideas were not taken into account by whatever smoke-filled room Marcus assembles to make his plan. Assuming he even survives what sounds to me like a somewhat harebrained endeavor. The crew of the original James Caird had used celestial navigation to find their way across hundreds of leagues of stormy seas to the coast of South Georgia Island. The crew of the new Caird would have to do something similar. It was easier for them. The navigator on James Caird had had no choice but to await breaks in the ever-present cloud cover and snatch observations when he could, comparing them against a mechanical chronometer that he hoped was still telling true time. New Caird had better timepieces and a better view of the sky. In place of a sextant, they had a device consisting of a wide-angle lens and a high-resolution image sensor that could tell what direction it was aimed in just by comparing what it saw to an astronomical database stored in its memory. So they knew precisely how they were oriented in space, and how that orientation was shifting as the giant shard of ice, to which they were attached, progressed through the inexorable mathematics of its long ellipse. That, combined with direct measurements of Earth's position, enabled Marcus to calculate the parameters of their orbit and to reckon, with precision that grew each time he rechecked the figures, exactly how low they were going to go. Whenever Izzy was on their side of the planet, which was about half the time, they were able to get the latest figures from Dube concerning the expansion of the atmosphere. It was in combining those two sets of figures that pure Newtonian mechanics began to break down. For, in a traditional calculation of a space vehicle's trajectory, one assumed no atmosphere and no extraneous forces resulting from it. But there was now no denying that Ymir would be going low enough to scrape the air. At a minimum, this meant it would experience some drag that would throw off the course that Sean Probst had laid in. As these things went, drag wasn't that difficult to calculate. Its effect on their course could be estimated. But because the ice shard wasn't a symmetrical body coming in straight, it was also going to generate some lift. Not a lot of lift, nothing like an airplane wing, but some. If that lift got aimed in the wrong direction, it would make Ymir veer downward, like a stricken airplane going into its death spiral. But if they aimed it up, it would ease their passage by pushing them away from the Earth into an altitude where air was thinner. They would lose the benefit of lift then and drift back downward, but as the air got thicker, the lift would resume and push them back up. They might skip off the atmosphere several times during the hectic half-hour when they were slingshotting around the world. The results would have been difficult to predict even if Ymir had been a traditional vehicle with a fixed and regular shape. But the shard was irregular. They didn't have time to measure it and to feed the data into an aerodynamic simulator, so they could only guess how much lift it was going to produce. And when its leading edge and its underside began to plow through the air, even though the air might be so thin as to be indistinguishable, for most purposes, from a vacuum, it was going to heat up. Steam would rise from it, producing some amount of upward thrust, and its shape would change. So even if they had been able to simulate the shard's aerodynamics, its lift and its drag, those numbers would quickly have become wrong during its first encounter with the upper air. Compared with all of those complexities, the fact that Ymir would be flying backward while operating a damaged experimental nuclear propulsion system at maximum power seems like a mere detail. Faced with so many imponderables, a well-managed aerospace engineering project would have called a halt to all further work and devoted several years to analyzing the problem down to its minutest detail, exposing pieces of ice to the blast of hypersonic wind tunnels, building simulations, and wargaming possible alternative strategies.
But by the time Marcus understood the general shape of the problem, they had 24 hours remaining to perigee. The tangerine earth had grown to the size of an orange. No power wielded by humans could prevent Ymir from passing around it and scraping the atmosphere. They couldn't even ditch. New Caird, detached from Ymir, didn't have enough propellant in her tanks to materially change her course and would end up going on the same ride anyway. So Marcus made a reasonable guess as to what would be a good angle of attack, the orientation that Ymir would adopt vis-a-vis the atmosphere, and initiated a program of thruster firings that, over the course of half a day, swung the ponderous shard around into the position he deemed best. Ymir's stern was now aimed in the direction of movement. The huge mouth of the nozzle aimed forward so that it could make the all-important braking burn. But she was now twisted about her long axis in such a way that New Caird, still docked up near the bow and projecting from the side of the shard at approximately a right angle, was on the zenith. This meant that during the passage of the high atmosphere, her view of the earth below would be blocked by Ymir. The nozzle of her engine pointed up toward the stars. Firing that engine would therefore tend to rotate the bow downward and the stern up, an attitude likely to produce more lift and help get Ymir out of trouble. Were the shard to tumble the other direction, it could end up in a position that would yield much more drag and much less lift, pulling the whole contraption deep into the atmosphere. In effect, New Caird had been reduced to the status of a small attitude control thruster. It was a thruster that could only push in one direction, and so Marcus had picked out the direction most likely to be useful if things began to go sideways. Vyacheslav would ride it out in New Caird's pilot seat, from which he would enjoy an arm's-length tunnel vision view of some dirty 5-billion-year-old ice. He would wait for a verbal command from Marcus, ensconced in Ymir's common room, to fire New Caird's main propulsion if needed. All of this was mere background noise to Dinah, who was entirely consumed with coordinating the efforts of robots. The number of gnats was in the tens of thousands. They could only be talked to collectively as swarms. Trying to address and control them one by one, while theoretically possible, was a mug's game. Their general task was to morph the shard. One swarm would be working on the inner surface of the nozzle bell. At the moment, all of those were out on the back end of the shard, sunning themselves to build up their internal reserves of power. At a signal from Dinah, they would all converge on the circular maw of the nozzle, climb down into the bell, and spread out to reshape it as needed during the burn. They'd be running a program that Lars had developed and tweaked, so all Dinah really needed to do was to turn them on. Likewise, the smallest of the three swarms was down inside the ice hoppers, running Lars's program for keeping rocks away from the augers. Working in the dark, these had to sip power from electrical taps that Ymir's crew had installed for that purpose. The largest of the three swarms, though, was responsible for sculpting the interior of the big shard as it was hollowed out. By the time the journey to Izzy was finished, most of the ice would have been fed into the hoppers and blown out the nozzle, leaving a hollowed-out shell with just enough internal structure to hold the reactor in place and maintain some semblance of a nozzle bell. This was not as crazy as it sounded, for two reasons. First, it was what miners had done since time immemorial. They didn't just hollow out mountains, since that would lead to collapse. They sculpted the mountains into structurally sound architectural systems, complete with pillars, arches, and vaults. This was just that, except that the material was ice, and the forces in general were not as large. Secondly, most of the shard's interior was of little consequence from a structural engineering standpoint. There was a reason why airplanes and race cars had been hollow shells, all skin and no bones. Most structural forces were naturally transmitted through the outermost layer of the vehicle, so that was the best place to put the strength. Enough strength on the outside made it possible to leave the inside hollow. Ice, of course, wasn't the best material to work with. It was brittle. But the Ymir expedition had shipped out carrying a large supply of high-strength plastic cord, net, fabric, and loose fiber. And during the months that it had been coasting in from Grieg Skellerup, Lars's robots had been at work converting ice into pycrete. That outer layer of visually black ice was no longer ice per se, but a synthetic material with much better structural properties. Frozen, it could stop bullets. Melted and strained, it would separate into water, artificial fibers, and black crud from the dawn of the solar system. In any case, the larger robots, the Grabs and the Siwas, responsible for doing most of the heavy material removal on the inside, could scrape to within a few meters of that outer skin without compromising Ymir's structure. It was the responsibility of the third gnat swarm to clean up after them and maintain the internal pillars and webs that would keep the reactor and the hoppers suspended in the middle of the hollow shard. This swarm-based ice-sculpting algorithm had been Lars's invention, and he'd had a couple of years in which to perfect it. But Dinah was in charge of it now, and had a lot of learning to do between now and when she became fully responsible for it. Outnumbered by the gnats, but responsible for moving a much larger tonnage of ice, were the 100 or so Grabs and Siwas, now mostly stationed at the ready around the shard's interior. Most of these were general-purpose robots with some added-on bits that made them good at moving on ice. But there were also half a dozen leather-face machines. Upsized Grabs with shovel-studded chainsaws for limbs, made to move a lot of ice in a hurry. These were so good at their jobs that they tended to destroy their surroundings, so they had to move frequently. Each one had to be followed around by an entourage of smaller robots cleaning up its mess and getting it anchored to fresh locations. In theory, it was all just a big computer program that, when executed, would smoothly convert the solid hill of ice into something like a walnut with the meat removed. A thick, pockmarked outer shell with an organic internal system of ribs, veins, and webs. As with any other computer program, it might run perfectly when Dinah started it. But it might just as well go sideways, perhaps in a manner that wasn't obvious at first. So, situational awareness was going to be a big part of her task. Interesting as it might be to look out the window and watch the Earth screaming by at 24,000 miles per hour, she would need to keep her head down, searching through a roar of weak and ambiguous signals for signs that something was going awry. She liked to imagine that her days as a little girl in a mining camp, sitting in front of a radio console, trying to pick out Morse code signals from far away, through static and crosstalk, might have prepared her for it in some way. A few minutes into his Skype conversation with JBF, Dub realized that, 2 years ago, he had done his job too well. He'd gone into that meeting at Camp David with the mission of getting the president to understand the exponential breakup of the moon that was going to wipe out life on the Earth's surface. Putting on his Doc Dubois hat, he had coined the terms white sky and hard rain as easy-to-grasp handles on phenomena that, truth be told, were much more complicated. Dr. Harris was now wishing that the late Doc Dubois had never opened his big fat mouth. He was in a corner of the farm that, since the departure of New Caird, had developed into a sort of bullpen where he and Conrad and some of the other orbital mechanics geeks hung out. The farm had always operated something like a high school cafeteria, with different cliques habitually sitting in certain areas, and now those choices were hardening, becoming a part of Izzy's unwritten procedure manual. Anyway, they had printed out charts and plots representing, in more or less abstract form, everything that they knew about the ongoing development of the lunar debris cloud and what it might mean for the future of the cloud arc. The expenditure of paper and printer ink had been somewhat lavish,
Two generations from now, if any humans survived, they would look on this heap of documents with some combination of disgust and amazement. Because paper was going to be scarce by then, and they would view its use for such purposes in roughly the same way as Americans of the 21st century had viewed the use of sperm whale oil to fuel street lamps. But then life would get better. Forests of genetically engineered trees would grow in vast rotating space colonies, paper would become plentiful, and these sad yellowed scraps would be displayed in a museum as evidence of the privations suffered by the Arkers. Assuming they didn't screw it up. Which was really the topic of this Skype call with Julia. She was floating in her arklet. She seemed to have adjusted to zero G. She'd figured out how to pull her hair close to her head. The moon face had abated. She wasn't visibly nauseated. People were drifting to and fro in the background. The only one Doob recognized was Camilla. A couple of other kids were doing what looked like work, prodding and massaging their tablets purposefully, looking up from time to time to engage in brief conversations. A South Asian lad, an African girl, another girl who's probably Chinese. Girl, kid, lad, girl. His politically correct superego, cultivated during long years of service in academia, was trying to light up his shame neurons. Doob felt no shame. He was way past that. But he was struck by just how young the Arkies were, how different they were demographically from the general population. It gave him a vaguely troubling sense of being out of touch. It had been decades since he had been young. But he had always been one of the cool kids anyway, with a big following on Facebook and Twitter. Now he was stuck on Izzy, and Julia was stuck in an arklet. The two of them were hanging out with completely different populations. G-poppers saw each other all the time and talked face-to-face. Arkies were isolated in their arklets and had to use social media to reach out. Doob hadn't looked at his Facebook page since the white sky, and this call with Julia had been delayed for 15 minutes while he'd tried to figure out the user interface on Skype. Something with which Julia was obviously familiar and comfortable. She used it all the time, and if it didn't work, one of those kids in the background would help her with it. Another straw in the wind. While Doob had been fumbling with Skype, he had overheard a brief snatch of conversation from the other end in which the South Asian kid had addressed Julia as Madam President. This seemed so odd that he was tempted to bring it up in conversation. But he knew what the answer would be. It was just a courtesy. Former presidents were always addressed thus. It didn't mean anything. Why was he making a big deal about it? He would come off as some combination of uncouth and comically hypersensitive. "Dr. Harris, as you know, I'm something of a fifth wheel around here. And so I want you to know I appreciate your taking any time at all out of whatever it is you are busy with to touch base," Julia began.
"Not at all, Madam Julia,"
Doob said, and then, because this was a video connection, resisted the urge to slap himself. She found that interesting, but decided to overlook it. "I feel like a camp counselor here," she said. "Of course, I was on top of every detail of the architect's work during the run-up, but to sit in the White House looking at PowerPoints is one thing. Actually, to be here is quite another." This was quite obviously bait. Fully aware of what a sucker he was being, Doob said,
"How so?"
"Well, of course, the range of cultural perspectives is vast," Julia said. "But modulo that, I find a lot of uncertainty, a sense that all of the Arkies' talents and energies are bottled up, like so many genies just waiting for someone to rub the lantern. They all so keenly want to help."
"It is, of course, less than 2 weeks since the hard rain began,"
Doob pointed out.
"We have 5,000 or so years left to go."
"The Arkie community is well aware of those numbers," Julia remarked.
"The Arkie community. Well."
He had to admire the way she'd slipped that in.
"Julia, what's the purpose of this call?" Am I to understand that whatever answers I give you will then be somehow disseminated to the Arki community? Because we have an email list for such purposes. An email list that includes every living human being.
That list was most recently used 2 days ago, an eternity for bottled-up Arkis.
We have been just a tad busy with the new Caird expedition.
There is a lot of curiosity about that in the Arki community.
There's a lot of curiosity about it here.
I mean about its purpose, Julia said.
How could its purpose be any clearer?
Dube asked.
Anyone who made it through the screening and the training required to be an Arki.
Which doesn't include you, Julia.
We'll understand exactly what we are trying to do from an orbital mechanics standpoint.
Obtain the stupendous amount of water that will have to be expended in order to attempt the Big Ride Gambit, Julia said. Yes, Dr. Harris. Even I understand that.
Gambit? Really?
Do representatives of the G-Pop ever make much of an effort to reach out and acquaint themselves with the thoughts and perceptions of the AC? Julia asked.
The what?
The Arki community, Julia explained, with the slightest roll of her eyes.
At any given time, about 10% of the Arkis are rotating through Izzy. You know this. It is the largest number we can accommodate.
I've talked to several who have experienced that rotation. They all report the same thing. As soon as one enters the privileged environment of Izzy, with safer conditions, more room to move about, better food, and greater exposure to senior staff, the G-Pop worldview seems so sensible, which only accentuates the reentry shock upon being deposited back into one's arklet. Dube bit his tongue. Julia continued, "What about reversing the roles a little? Sending members of the G-Pop on temporary homestays in randomly selected arklets?"
"What about it?"
Dube asked.
"What purpose would it really serve?"
"From a purely technocratic standpoint, perhaps none whatsoever," Julia said, and left the rest of her thought unsaid.
"If I went on a homestay in a random arklet, what would I learn that I can't learn from Scape or Spacebook?"
"A great deal, since you don't actually use those applications," said Julia, her voice deepening in amusement.
"I'm a little busy trying to get new Caird home. Go ahead, tell me, what am I missing?"
Movement caught his eye across the table. He looked up to see Louisa shaking her head. Then Louisa clamped her face between her palms, closed her eyes for a moment, and opened them. Dube felt his face warming and once again resisted the temptation to slap himself. "There is a lot of ferment in the AC around alternative strategies," Julia said, speaking briskly and authoritatively, as befit a woman who had just been anointed the spokesperson for said Arki community. "A fascinating school of thought is developing around the idea of making a passage through clean space to Mars."
"Clean space?"
"Oh, I forget. You haven't been following the relevant discussion groups. Clean space is just what Tav has been calling the translunar zone, relatively free of bolides."
"Tav? Tavistock Prowse?"
"Yes. You should have a look at your old friend's blog occasionally." Tav had been sent up to Izzy a month before the White Sky, when someone on the ground had decided that social media was going to be the glue that would hold the Cloud Ark together, and that Tav was just the man for that sort of thing.
"I've been busy,"
Dube said.
"But Tav ought to know that we have simulated and wargamed the Mars option to within an inch of its life, and it's just not a good idea."
He could see Julia formulating an objection that he didn't have the patience to listen to.
"Anyone who is seriously advocating we go to Mars is..."
He didn't want to say what he was thinking, which was smoking crack, and so he settled for
"not taking some of the practical realities into account." One solar flare at the wrong time could kill everyone.
Only if everyone goes.
If you're talking about just sending a contingent to Mars, then you have to consider how much of our equipment and supplies they'll be allowed to take with them.
I think many talented Arkies would volunteer to be part of a small, lean advance party. The lure of clean space is strong.
Well, we are not in what I guess Tav considers clean space,
Dube said.
We are in dirty space, and we have to focus on that reality, rather than wool-gathering about trips to the Red Planet.
You needn't remind me, Julia began.
Yes. You saw your friend and colleague Pete Starling get chowdered by a bolide. I did actually see your Spacebook post about that, Julia. It was most affecting. I sense a but coming, however.
As the days go by without a serious incident, people begin to wonder how dirty space really is. Interest grows in the dump-and-run option. The white sky now feels like ancient history. The hard rain is upon us. Every day brings a course correction or two to avoid a major bolide, and a litany of minor events. But the death toll stands at
18, as of 10 minutes ago,
Dube said.
We just lost Arklet 52. See, I am keeping my ear to the ground.
I am sorry to hear that, Julia said, and I'll bet the rest of the AC will feel the same way, once that news has been distributed to them.
It's on a fucking spreadsheet, Julia. All you have to do is look at it. We don't distribute news. This is not the White House.
But in many respects, it behaves like the White House, Julia said. An orbiting White House, unfettered by constitutional checks and balances. But at least the White House had a briefing room, a way of reaching out. I would be happy to—
Why are you even talking to me about this?
Dube asked.
I'm a fucking astronomer.
Then a thought.
How many conversations like this one have you been having with other members of the G-Pop?
He'd been assuming that Julia had singled him out as special. But for all he knew, she had a call list as long as her arm, organized by those assiduous youngsters in the background.
Ivy is temporarily in charge.
I am familiar with the chain of command that has been improvised, Julia returned. To answer your question, Dr. Harris, I am talking to you precisely because you are an astronomer and well-positioned to answer the questions and concerns among the AC about the exact nature of the dirty space threat. This news from Arklet 52 is going to raise questions about the effectiveness of Ivy's current strategy.
It is a statistical problem,
Dube said.
On about A plus 0.7, it stopped being a Newtonian mechanics problem and turned into statistics. It has been statistics ever since. And it all boils down to the distribution of bolide sizes, and of the orbits in which they are moving, and how those distributions are changing over time, which we can only know from observation and extrapolation. And you know what, Julia? Even if we had perfect knowledge of every single one of those statistical parameters, we still wouldn't be able to predict the future. Because we have an N of one. Only one cloud arc. Only one Izzy to work with. We can't run this experiment 1,000 times to see the range of different outcomes. We can only run it once. The human mind has trouble with situations like that. We see patterns where they don't exist. We find meaning in randomness. A minute ago, you were casting doubt on whether dirty space was really that dirty at all, obviously arguing in favor of dump and run. Then I told you about what just happened to Arklet 52, and now you're swinging around to the other point of view. You are not helping, Julia. You are not helping.
Julia did not look to be accepting Dube's remarks in the spirit intended. Instead, she squinted through the screen at him and shook her head slightly. I don't understand the intensity of your reaction, Dr. Harris.
This conversation is over,
Dube said, and hung up on her. He then fought off a temptation to slam the tablet down on the table. Instead, he sat back in his chair and looked Louisa in the eye for the first time in a while. On one level, he'd wanted to watch her face the whole time. But Julia would have noticed that, would have figured out that someone else was in the room, silently listening. Just as someone had probably been doing at Julia's end. Louisa just sat there, in her listening shrink mode.
It would be easier, Dube said, if I could figure out what the hell she wanted.
You're assuming, Louisa said, that she has a plan. I doubt that she does. She is driven to seek power. She finds some way to do that and then backfills a rationalization for it afterward. Dube pulled his tablet closer and started trying to find Tav's blog.
To what extent do you imagine she really is reporting facts about the AC, as opposed to creating the reality she describes?
Dube asked. What's the difference? Louisa asked. Dinah looked up and saw that the Earth was the size of a grapefruit. She took a nap, ate some food, and buckled down to work again, then looked up to see that it was the size of a basketball. Still not that big, and yet such was their speed that it was only an hour away. They had a final briefing session in Ymir's common room, which had become a makeshift bridge for this ungainly ship. Dinah had scrounged 3 flat-panel monitors from various parts of the command module and zip-tied them to the common room table. These were covered with overlapping windows of various sizes. Some were terminal windows showing log entries or editors showing code, but most were video feeds showing different robots' points of view on the mining operation. Only one of them looked outward. She'd positioned a redundant SIY on the stern, toward the nadir, and aimed its camera at Earth. Other than that, her only situational awareness would come from a celestial navigation program that would display, in a small window, a 3-dimensional rendering of the Earth with Ymir's trajectory superimposed on it as a geometric curve. Along the bottom of that window was a series of graphs plotting velocity and altitude versus time. Their velocity at the moment was some 6,000 meters per second, up from 4,000 just a couple of hours ago. Within the next hour, it would double if they took no action, then begin to drop again as they left perigee behind and coasted away into space. That velocity would take them all the way back out to L1 again, unless Jiro succeeded at his task, which was to slow them down. He had satisfied himself with but a single flat-panel screen, which he'd set up directly across the table from Dinah's triptych. From here, he would be managing the reactor. He had already begun to pull some of the control blades, just to get a sense of how quickly it would come to full power when he did it for real. A miscalculation on that front had led to the fuel rod breach that had indirectly killed Sean, and Jiro didn't want any surprises this time around. Some minutes before perigee, if Marcus felt that things were otherwise going to plan, Jiro would issue commands that would bring the reactor up to its full thermal power output of about 4 gigawatts. Ice would melt to superheated water, and steam would howl through the Inconel throat of the nozzle, expanding and cooling in the bell until it turned into a hypersonic blizzard, a white lance of cold fire pushing against the great ship's movement, slowing her down. Not so much as to let her fall into the atmosphere and die, but enough to reduce her orbit to something more like Izzy's. Ymir would experience acceleration, which would feel to its inhabitants like gravity. All the stuff that was now floating around loose aboard Ymir and New Caird would fall down. Dinah and Jiro would drop into the chairs that they'd positioned in front of their monitors. So would Marcus, for he had built his own nest of tablets and monitors at the head of the table, mostly occupied with navigational data. Up in New Caird, Slava would find himself pressed into his acceleration couch at an awkward sideways angle. The G-forces would be modest enough.
even a 4-gigawatt nuclear propulsion system could only exert so much force against the momentum of such a large chunk of ice. If their weight remained steady over time, it was a sign that things were going well. If it increased, it probably meant that they were going to die. For the only thing that could slow them down and increase their perceived weight beyond a certain level was contact with the atmosphere. The more they slowed down, the lower they dropped. The lower they dropped, the thicker the air got. The thicker the air got, the more force it exerted on the ship. They would read this as a sense of increased weight. It was an exponential spiral that, beyond a certain point, would lead to the inevitable destruction of Ymir, Nukaird, and everyone on board. The only real question would be the manner of their death. In a smaller, lighter craft, they might be burned alive. Here, being surrounded by ice, it was more likely that they would lose consciousness from the G-forces first. A relatively painless way to go. Dubois Harris and Conrad Barth, gazing down on them from a few hundred kilometers above, would see them go out as a blue streak over the southern hemisphere, and would give the news to Ivy so that she could issue a statement to the Cloud Ark that, if Dinah was any judge of her friend, she had already written, just in case she needed it. It was strange to be so close to them in distance, but so far away in the non-intuitive space of Delta Vs. Bandwidth between Nukaird and Izzy was excellent now, and Dinah had to make a conscious effort not to get distracted by the availability of text messaging and even Spacebook. "See you in a few, XOXO," Ivy had texted her, and Dinah had sent back something in the same vein, then closed the window. Vyacheslav was donning one of the blue thermal garments worn beneath spacesuits. This, she knew, was just a precaution, in case he had to go outside, on short notice for some reason. Slava had stationed his spacesuit in Nukaird's airlock so that he could exit to the outside of the shard if needed, and Dinah had pre-positioned 2 grabs there to help him get around. Marcus could be pretty unceremonious about things, which was just his leadership style. His way of implicitly telling people he expected them to do their bloody jobs without pep talks beforehand or congratulations afterward. It didn't work for everyone. Some people liked ceremony. But he hadn't invited any of those along on this expedition. So there was no particular moment when it all started. They just kept getting closer to the Earth. Slava darted up the companionway to the top of the command module, and a minute later announced that he was positioned before the controls of Nukaird. Jiro called out milestones in the startup of the reactor, occasionally proffering hints as to how the figures should be understood. "That is a little faster than I expected. Settling down now. This is according to plan. Ready to proceed on your command." And so on. Marcus's participation consisted largely of chewing his thumbnail while staring fixedly at his screen. From time to time he would reach out and type something, or swipe and tap on his tablet. Dinah's work was almost entirely abstract, several layers removed from what obviously mattered. She tried to focus on it, and to ignore the sounds of 1,000 loose objects settling to the floor of Ymir as gravity came on, due to a combination of Ymir's increasing thrust and the steady buildup of atmospheric pushback.
"Now,"
Marcus said.
"Acknowledged," Jiro responded. "Control blades are responding to program, and we have criticality."
4 gigawatts of thermal power, enough to supply Las Vegas, came online in the next few seconds. Dinah felt it as a massive increase in weight, and heard it as a cacophony of creaks, groans, and crashing noises as the command module, and the ice surrounding it, came under structural load. She saw it on her screens as sudden and frantic change in windows that had remained frustratingly static for the last hours. The ice hoppers, which had been brimful for weeks, began to empty at a shocking pace as the augers spun. A couple of her point-of-view robots fell or skidded from their points of anchorage, events that showed up as sudden and unhelpful shifts in camera angle. She hit go on a program that tasked every robot in the shard to deliver more ice into the hoppers as fast as possible, and tried to keep one eye on that while monitoring the structural integrity of the shard as a whole. In the traditional scheme of things, miners had done all their work under gravity, so structural mistakes had manifested themselves soon, and dramatically, as cave-ins. Ymir was a mine that had been slowly delved under zero-G, and only subjected to gravity for short periods when the engine came on. And so there was a certain nervous feeling of not knowing whether it might all collapse. So far, it looked fine.
"We are losing velocity nicely," Marcus muttered through what was left of his thumbnail,
and Dinah permitted herself a glance at the graphs to verify that this was so. Time had gone by faster than she had known. They were just minutes away from perigee. Nicely, in Marcus's phrasing, meant enough to make a difference, but not so much as to kill us. Then Marcus said,
"Slava, a 3-second burn, please."
"Da,"
answered the Russian. Then a few seconds later he said,
"It is beginning."
They wouldn't have known Slava was doing anything save for an external camera that Dinah had positioned on the surface of the shard at some distance from New Caird, looking back at it. This showed a ghostly blue flare emerging from the small ship's nozzle bell, shoving Ymir's nose down and swinging its stern up slightly. Ymir shuddered faintly. Dinah didn't know what to make of it. She feared it might be a cave-in until she identified it as a sensation she had never expected to feel again. Atmospheric buffeting. She had not been this close to the surface of the Earth since she'd been launched into orbit almost a year before zero. And if the next few minutes went well, she'd never be this close again. The shuddering didn't last. The graphs on her screen had all picked up little wiggles that were steadily receding into the past.
"We skipped," Marcus said. "I think we will do it at least one more time."
"Augurs 4 and 11 are down," Jiro announced. "I will try reversing them to clear the jam."
This brought Dinah's attention back. At a glance, she checked all of the levels in the hoppers and saw them dropping quickly, as expected, despite the robot's efforts to replenish them. The two that Jiro had identified were overfull, since there was no way to get the ice out of them. Dinah activated a sub-program that would put some grabs to work, transferring surplus ice from hoppers 4 and 11 to nearby ones that could use it.
"The Caird burn worked," Marcus said, "but it gave us a little too much rotation. I am counteracting using thrusters. And this will take a little while."
He entered some commands that, presumably, turned on those of Ymir's attitude thrusters that pushed in the opposite direction from New Caird's big engine.
"By the way, we just passed through perigee, I hope."
Dinah glanced at the plots and saw that they had indeed passed the midway point of the maneuver. Somewhat paradoxically, though, their altitude was dropping, headed for their second, and hopefully their last, skip off the atmosphere. "We're on some weird new course now," she said.
"It is true," Marcus said. "If we survive the next few minutes, we can fix it later."
"Augur 11 works again," Jiro reported, "but 2 and 3 are down. We may have a critical propellant shortage."
"Damned thrusters are not powerful enough. They have overcorrected," Marcus said. "And now they are coming in for another skip. They are flying not only backward, but upside down."
So the burn from New Caird's engine had done its job. It had depressed the ship's nose, which was pointed backward, and prevented the stern, currently pointed forward, from digging in. They'd grazed the atmosphere with the shard's broadside and gotten a nice skip out of it, a bounce that might have saved their lives. But once the shard began to rotate, it was difficult to make it stop,
and now it had gone too far. The nose was pointed too steeply downward. The nozzle bell was aimed up toward space.
So we're thrusting down toward the planet now?
Dinah asked.
Not enough to hurt us. Maintain thrust,
Marcus ordered.
I am running out of ice, Jiro said, and glanced over his monitor at Dinah.
Dinah had already warned them that supplying enough propellant to do all of this in one huge burn would be a close-run thing, assuming everything went perfectly. Everything hadn't. She met Jiro's eyes, shook her head, and went back to work.
Get ready to shut it down, Jiro,
Marcus said.
We are descending into thick air, and I don't know what is going to happen.
Their inner ears told them that something was happening. The powerful thrust was still driving them into their seats, but some force had taken Ymir by the nose and was torquing it around.
We hit nose first, Marcus said, and we are spinning back. Main engine shut down in 3, 2, 1, now.
A nuclear steam engine didn't shut off quickly. The thrust faltered and tapered off in response to whatever commands Jiro had entered. It was the better part of a minute, though, before they were back in zero gravity, meaning in a free orbit with no thrust pushing them around.
I'll give you our new orbital parameters in a minute, Marcus said. It is complicated because we are tumbling.
In the sudden silence that followed the engine's shutoff, Dinah could hear a distant, tinny shouting. She realized it was an audio channel from Izzy, coming from a pair of headphones she'd ripped off her head during the maneuver. It was the sound of people in the tank. When she pulled the phones back onto her head, she could tell that they were celebrating.
That was a big-ass Delta V you guys just ripped off,
Dube said when he heard Dinah's voice on the other end of the link.
You deserve congratulations.
Dinah's response, after a few seconds' delay, was guarded.
But not big-ass enough?
It was strange hearing the voice of one you knew well, modulated through this old-school audio tech. Like hearing Dinah doing a Buzz Aldrin impression at a party. The emotional nuance came through more clearly than the actual words.
Conrad is still calculating your params,
Dube said.
But just on visual inspection, we can see how much you slowed down. Fantastic.
Sounds like we'll be needing another pass then, she said,
meaning that they would have to wait for Ymir to loop once more around the Earth and do another burn at her next perigee in order to slow down enough to rendezvous with Izzy.
This time you can work with a higher perigee,
he pointed out,
so you don't have to fly that damn piece of ice through the pea soup again.
Flying this damn piece of ice kind of stresses me out, Dinah allowed.
The glass is half full, baby,
Dube said.
The glass is half full. You lit that candle. It worked. You bounced off the atmosphere. You're a hell of a lot closer to us. Conrad is saying your apogee is definitely sublunar.
Meaning that Ymir would turn around and start falling back toward Earth before reaching the orbit of the former moon.
This is huge,
he added.
It is going to change the picture politically.
After a lengthy pause, Dinah asked,
politically?
As if she couldn't quite believe what she had heard.
I'm aware of the fact that Ivy has turned a deaf ear to all of your ideas,
Julia began, just as soon as Spencer had typed in the commands that disconnected Arklet 453 from the Situational Awareness Network. I presume she also went out of her way to place obstacles in the path of your coming here for this meeting. The Martians, Dr. Catherine Quine, Ravi Kumar, and Li Jianyu looked somewhat nonplussed. It was always difficult to travel between Arklets. The waiting time for non-urgent flivver trips was about 2 days, and emergencies could rearrange the queue at the last minute. As a member of the general population, Dr. Quine had the most Olympian perspective on this. She was an urgent care doctor, frequently called upon to make excursions to Arklets.
She was about 10 years older than Kumar and Janyu, who were Arkis chosen in the casting of lots from India and China, respectively. Those two had ended up together in Arklet 303, which had turned out to be a hotbed of Martian agitation. It was part of a triad with a total population of 18, half of whom currently had the flu, and so Catherine Quine had had a legitimate excuse to go there. She'd made the most of the opportunity by scooping up Ravi and Janyu and coming here with them. Of the people in this conversation, she was probably the least inclined to see dark deeds by Ivy in the slowness of inter-Arklet transport. It was a different story with Ravi and with Janyu, who, for a number of reasons, were receptive to Julia's suggestions on that front. In another time and place, Dr. Quine might have quibbled, but time was short, and trying to raise Julia's opinion of the Cloud Ark's current management did not seem like an efficient way to use it. So she let it go. And by the time she had processed all of that, Julia had moved on anyway. "Given that, I'm all the more appreciative that you made the arduous and risky journey to meet with me